Okay.
All
Let's
right.
roll.
All right. Welcome to Recovery Internet Radio, broadcast direct from Straight Up Studios. You know, I didn't look and see what episode we're on here, but I think, I want to say 38?
I want to say 38.
Let's go with 38. I think 38 is a pretty good number. I feel good about that.
38.
Finally feels a little bit like January here, so.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, it should be a good night. I'm going to give you to our host, Mr. Rick Atwater.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And welcome to our listeners tonight and our guest, Dr. Ramesh Vemuri. Let's see. Our tag tonight is Q&A about medication and recovery with Doc V. And we are here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, so we hope that you will join us when you get a chance. And thanks to our engineer tonight, Chris Atwater.
Hey, I will say we are working with some new equipment here, so if anything sounds a little off, I think we got it dialed in though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if it sounds goofy, call us immediately. We'll,
yeah,
and we probably won't do anything about it.
Yeah, well, I just like to know. That number, by the way, if you want to call, is area code 323-792-2977.
Yeah. That's exactly right. That was my next. That was the next line on my page here, dude.
Oh well, I'm sorry about that. Well,
okay.
You can call for, you know, if we're having technical difficulties, I'd love to know about it. But we'd love to hear from you. And
we
if
would.
If you have questions during the show about the guest, any questions for Rick or Dr. V, please feel free to give us a call.
We would. Yes, we would like. We would definitely like that. And you can also tweet us at Rick Atwater.
Tweet.
And you can tweet us in such a way that we will get your tweet during the show, and we can respond to said tweet on the show live. So
that's like the magic of technology right there.
You got it.
Right.
Also, please remember to check out recoveryinternetradio.com for all our archive shows and recovery resources. We've got a couple of people that we like to plug. I'm going to save that for later or at halftime. Because I like to sort of get right at what we're here to talk about.
Okay.
So, so again, thanks for coming out on this beautiful
cold
night.
Cold Sunday night.
The first question I had I sent these to you, so I was, you know, I assume you kind of took a look at them. But the first question I had was, you know, you've worked quite a bit with people that have addictions problems.
Yes.
And have done that for a while.
33 years.
How long?
33 years.
33. Okay. So you kind of know the territory?
I hope so.
I think so. I think your reputation is that you do.
Thank you.
What percentage of the people that you see have addiction as part of their case? Issues.
Since I went to treatment in 2001, I tend to do more addiction psychiatry in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I probably had less than 5%.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have. Now again, opiates became such a big issue in McHenry County.
Right.
So, and there are newer drugs like Suboxone,
mm-hmm.
which increased my practice percentage-wise. Probably,
yeah.
I'd say 20 to 25%.
Okay, yeah, it would increase the. Yeah, I was thinking, do they find you or do you find them?
Both.
Because when you're open, it seems to me like when you're open to it, especially if you have your personal knowledge of it, it just people will find you.
Like friends like you, who know I'm in.
Yeah, yeah.
I go to AA and I do the right things at least.
Yeah.
People who feel safe sending to a psychiatrist who has an addiction background.
Right.
Before,
right.
You know, the stigma about psychiatrists is that they prescribe medications.
Right.
Like Valium, Clonopin, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So there's a lot of stigma about psychiatrists in addiction. Now with the newer drugs and more awareness about Prashna programs.
Yeah.
You know, when I did my residency, I mean, I didn't know anything about Prashna program. I mean, I know, you know, they talk more about DTs and addictions and the consequences.
The medical part.
Refer them to AA.
Yeah.
Until you go to AA, what it's all about. I mean, before 2001, I only know one thing, which is step one, which is you're powerless in front of alcohol, your life becomes unmanageable. But for that, I don't know anything about other steps.
Right. Or what happens
after
that.
What happens afterwards.
Just go, say you're powerless, and hope that something good happens.
Yeah.
It's a good start.
Yeah, it does. Start, people sure. who follow through, it does.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, then you don't know what to do with them.
Right. So do you think that they're more astute about that now in medical school? Is there more training for people incoming?
More training, even hospital administrators now. Right. Let's say if you're an impaired physician, first thing they say is, one, they send you to an addictionologist. Two, they make sure you go through A.
Mm-hmm.
So typically what happens is, let's say you're a nurse, physician, or any pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
And once they find out you're an impaired professional,
mm-hmm.
they send you to an impaired professional program,
right?
Which is very well monitored for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
They make sure that you are clean, you go to meetings, and they have a caseworker who checks on you
mm-hmm.
every couple of weeks,
mm-hmm.
and random screenings and all
right.
those things.
Right.
And they also do, there's a new test called EGD testing, which in fact what happened to me was, one time I used a hand sanitizer.
Oh.
Week later, you test negative. Yeah, I mean, you test positive.
Test positive for alcohol?
Just touching. Hand sanitizer.
Oh, wait.
Such a specific test. Now, there's no way.
Is that a blood test?
Urine test.
Mm-hmm.
So they look for the metabolites.
Right.
So they're so specific. For 10 days, you touch alcohol, it will show up. Just like marijuana for 35 days.
Is that a commonly used test now, or doesn't? I don't think it is.
It's the same price, but it's not commonly used. Usually when you send for a urine toxicology or drug screen, the 10 panel or 12 panel they do a routine test where if you didn't drink that night, it doesn't show anything.
Right.
You know, but when you are in an impaired professional program, they make sure they're more careful, because when you test randomly, let's say I'm tested on December 15th or December 25th.
Right.
I know most likely I won't be tested until January 10th. I have the room to drink.
Right.
And stop around 8th or 9th.
And then it won't show
it
on
won't
a regular
show
test.
Regular test, it won't show.
But this test, yes.
There's no way you can.
Now, see, I thought that alcohol was only tested either breath or blood. I didn't know. Because the test that, I mean, I use tests too, and the mm-hmm. tests that I use don't include alcohol. If we have alcohol issues, we use a breath, you know, breathalyzer, right. But that's only 24 hours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't have anything that would do, you know, like 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time. Well, yeah. Does that help keep people on track
on
a little
track,
bit better?
Yeah.
Well,
you can't lie.
Yeah, you can't mess around.
The key thing
with
about
it.
Mm-hmm. addictions is dishonesty.
Mm-hmm.
We always figure out how to do it. So that gets you in an honest track, because you can't mess with it.
So because mm-hmm. there's more awareness of that, doctors and nurses and other medical professionals can be impaired, that changes the attitude of the whole profession.
Exactly.
Or at least it helps.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I went to impaired physician program in Schaumburg.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to go to meetings in Schaumburg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like 14 MDs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quite a few.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
in
quite
recovery.
A few.
Yeah.
And I know lawyers have, you know, lawyers,
pilots,
mm-hmm. you know. So I guess it happens to everybody.
Obviously, they say equal opportunity disease. It can happen to anyone.
It can happen to anybody.
Yeah. Only thing is, physicians are more difficult to treat.
Yeah.
I mean, so most impaired physician programs, minimum is 90 days inpatient. Minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Then can go up, if you're an anesthesiologist, it goes up to 180 days. They go by how much access do we have to chemicals.
Okay.
Anesthesiologists have a lot more access to opiates. And
the more access you have, the longer you're going to stay?
End up staying.
Yeah.
Even though, let's say, I'm an anesthesiologist, my drug of choice is alcohol, even then, I spend 6 months.
Ah, okay. Yeah. And then you mentioned that there are addictionologists now. It is a specialty.
It's been there quite some time. Yes.
Okay.
Actually, we have two boards for addiction. One is American Psychiatric Association has a two-year training in addiction medicine and has a board.
Okay.
It is also called ASAM.
Yeah.
I think you guys use that.
Yeah.
American Society of Addiction Medicine.
Addiction Medicine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's also been there probably 20 years.
20 years?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you go back and get...
I'm ASM certified, yes.
Okay. So you are considered an addictionologist.
Yes.
Okay. That's good to know. There's not many. I don't think there's really very... I don't think there's very many, at least in our area. Are there very many as a specialty compared to...
McHenry County, I don't think there's anybody really specialized. Dr. Brightwell does it too. I don't know that he has ASM certified or not. I'm not sure.
Okay. So you may be the only addictionologist in town.
Probably in, around this area.
Yeah. And in a general sense, in a broader sense, in other places in the country, is it a pretty small specialty, or are there more physicians specializing in addictions?
You know, at one time when Lutheran General was opening clinics everywhere, probably there were a lot more physicians who practice addiction medicine.
I see.
You know, Dr. Dude is one of Dr. Dude, for example.
Yeah.
He's a physician, but is in recovery. Started working at Lutheran General. He died, I think, about 4 years ago. But he used to be the in charge of the impaired physician program. And he's the greatest man. He's a big advocate of impaired physicians.
Yeah.
Really takes them under his wing, and help them recover.
He ran another hospital before he came to
Lutheran.
Yeah, Lutheran.
Okay.
I want to say I can't remember.
I think he worked in Mundelein. Remember Lutheran used to have
yeah
a center in Mundelein.
Yeah, Parkside.
Parkside. He used to run the Parkside.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, that's good. You know, it's good information because I don't think people really understand, really in general, number one, that it's a specialty, number two, that it's a good idea if they're going to see somebody, if they have an addictions problem, that they see somebody knowledgeable about the kind of medications, which is really where I kind of want to go tonight, because I my experience is there's a lot of recovering people that are on medications.
Yes.
More today than ever. And, you know, so... Well, first of all, I assume that the medications are primarily for what we would call co-occurring mental health problems.
Mostly.
Yeah. Mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, and you know, so.
You know what? Just really quick, what I wouldn't know what that was.
Okay.
Co-occurring.
Co-occurring.
Yeah.
Co-occurring means people having two illnesses, like you can have diabetes and hypertension.
Okay.
Same way you can have substance abuse problem. And also a depression, anxiety, ADD, something else.
So maybe you were already in treatment, but you might need something else for a different symptom, for a different problem.
Right. Apart from addictions, you might have another problem.
Got it. Okay.
It could be contributing. Sometimes, you know, my wife left me, I can't sleep at night, so I start drinking. Eventually, that becomes a problem. So it can start like this, or I have a problem, then my wife leaves me, then I get depressed, she left me.
So, either way, right?
So, I think about 90%, 90 to 100% of the alcoholics that I know want it to be the first way. My wife left me, then I drank. So then it's the wife's fault, and she's the one who has the psychiatric diagnosis. But I think that people don't, you know, in general, that wasn't as much as commonly accepted a notion, at least in the recovering community, as it is today. More so today, you think that?
I don't know, but if you look at the statistically, what they say is, when you go for co-occurring illnesses, the more deviant you are, in the sense, suppose you're a male alcoholic,
right,
your chances of having a co-occurring illness is about 10%.
Okay.
Women, it's almost 50%.
50%.
For alcoholism, right?
Okay.
The marijuana goes a little higher. So you go to IV drugs, you probably have up to 80% of the time, because you also have more deviant to get the drug. For me to get heroin, I have to go to Chicago, find a way, go to the south side,
right,
stay in the car. So the more deviant I am to get the drug, the more likely I have other psychiatric problems.
A co-occurring psychiatric problem. And what we don't know is that co-occurring psychiatric problem something that is there from the start or caused by the environment of the addiction. We don't know that.
Many times, the problem is it my experience because of my consequence? Let's say, I mean, obviously we all hit a bottom when
sure.
you're an addict.
Sure.
Then my wife leaves me, I lose my driving license, I lose my medical license. Of course, I'm going to be depressed.
Right.
It's a human emotion.
Right.
So I'm not going to call it as a co-occurring illness.
Right. It's not a diagnosis.
It's not a diagnosis. Even if I go to my doctor and say, I'm depressed, I don't see any purpose, I lost my house, I lost my wife, I lost my license, I'm going to be depressed. Am I going to treat that? I won't. I'm going to take it as a... is my human emotion of my consequences.
Sure.
So I need to help them to come out of that
right.
hopeless feeling, get on track, go to the whatever you need to do to maintain sobriety.
Right.
Obviously, Telstra program and the support will mm-hmm. help them. You know, but other people though usually is let's say my wife left me. I never had a problem before that.
Okay.
Then my wife left me. I can't sleep. So then I go to the bar and start drinking because I'm lonely.
Mm-hmm.
Then it slowly down. Then I get a DUI. Then I say, God, my life is unmanageable. I come to AA.
Right.
You can see
there's
a pattern. You know, let's say I'm drinking on the weekends, on Sundays after mowing the lawn, I got drunk
yeah.
every night. Then my wife leaves me. Then I get depressed. You can feel it. It's
right.
more a consequence of it.
Of the some would be more a consequence of the alcohol, and you can see that.
Most of the time you can't.
Yeah. And but other times it's when it's not, that's where you might be looking more at it as a disorder.
Yes.
And then when you treat that disorder, well, so we're talking about depression now.
Okay.
And I assume we could talk about anxiety mm-hmm. and some mm-hmm. of the other bipolar and things like that. But when you treat an alcoholic for depression, what kinds of things do you do? You know, I guess the word is psychopharmacologically.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with the drugs? How does that work?
So what happens is, in depression, typically what happens is, we believe there are two kinds of thinking, rational thinking and emotional thinking.
Okay.
Normally, they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
When you're depressed, you stop thinking rationally. You think emotionally. Nothing goes wrong for me. I look at one bad thing and say, my life sucks. You know. So the goal is, you know, whether you do pharmacologically or psychologically, is to make him to start using the rational thinking.
I get you.
Okay. So, well, I have a flat tire. Doesn't mean my life sucks.
The world is not ending.
Yeah.
Right.
I have 50,000 miles on my car, and of course I'm going to have a flat tire. I'm a lazy bum. I haven't checked my tires and changed the tires. You know. I'm not going to generalize one negative thing in my life and
okay.
say my life sucks.
Okay.
Because I'm a successful physician. I have so many positive things in my life.
Right.
So how soon I can start using my rational thinking. The medications, even when they work, they make it easier for you to think rationally.
Mm.
You know, one sad thing, you're not going to say, my life sucks. And
right.
well,
right.
It's okay. These are my choices. I can go on kind of thing. How soon can you do that? Even the medications, what we believe is, they make you think more rationally.
Uh-huh. And the medications today, what sort of medications are generally used today? I know the serotonin reuptake inhibitors are pretty.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was a mouthful that probably needs to be explained by you.
Okay. What happens in my experience? Again, I see a screwed patients. I see people, I don't see all alcoholics, so obviously I can't say all of them do.
Right.
The people who come to see a psychiatrist, they already have identified a problem. Let's say I feel sad, I don't see any hope, and my life sucks.
Right.
So we use drugs like SSRI. They're not a mood altering drugs, and they don't give you buzz, they don't give you, you can't get addicted, you can't abuse. So that, again, as mentioned earlier, they make you think rationally, so you don't feel so negative. You start looking at the choices in life,
right,
and see how else can I pull myself out of it. Okay, I need to go to AA, get my license back. You know, like all of we did. When
right.
we went to recovery, we did the right things to get whatever it takes for us to get the license, get my wife back, or find a new girlfriend who is supportive to me,
right,
and move on.
So, and it's, you know, to me, what you're saying is it's important for people to hear. Like, there's people who have consequences and feel sad and feel something that they might describe as depression, and those aren't people that need treatment.
They won't respond. Even if you
right.
come to me, and even if I put you on Prozac,
it won't make a difference.
It's not going to help those kind of things.
Right.
But generally, if you look at addictive diseases, basically it's a behavior nexus.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, we can't do anything in moderation. So we are kind of an obsessive personalities.
Right.
I'm talking about my experience in AA.
Right.
I'm not as a psychiatrist. When I go to my people, what they tell me in the groups, in my meetings, is
mm-hmm.
basically they are somewhat compulsive, perfectionistic,
mm-hmm.
kind of anxious people in general.
Right.
So
characterologically of that group. Sure.
Like majority of them.
Right.
Okay. So they tend to, you know, SSRIs are basically anti-compulsive drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So they might help, not drinking part, I'm talking about thinking part.
Right.
Which is, I won't be so obsessive, so dwelling on one negative thing and
say, yeah, well, catch up on the flat tire and make the world
end. Exactly.
And the other thing is, I think it's important for people to hear that those drugs are not mood altering.
Yes.
They're not addictive.
Yes.
And they're not habit.
Yeah, SSRIs and SNRIs, basically both kinds of drugs we use for depression.
Yeah.
Neither one of them are mood altering.
Okay.
Not like benzos or opiates.
Okay.
Or other drugs
they affect the thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, you hear people talk about, you know, that you don't take, you know, you're an AA, the 12 steps should be enough. And in some cases, that's true,
mm-hmm.
but not in every case.
Yes.
And that's where you come in.
Mm-hmm. My first experience in AA was, first meeting I went in 2001. So the old AA building,
uh-huh.
I walked in, the guy, first thing he asked me, what medication, you know, do you have a sponsor? I said, I don't have a sponsor. First meeting I went. Okay. He scared the hell out of me, asking my personal things about what medication you take, blah, blah, blah. Scared me. Then I didn't go to AA for a few months, thinking that if I take medication, they are going to throw stones at me. You're untouchable. You know,
right.
Some old timers have a rigid idea.
Yeah.
Because old times, yes, people used to give Valium. So addictive drugs,
yeah.
mood altering drugs. So substituting alcohol to Valium, I can understand the old way of thinking. But I see the younger guys, the new people are sober like 4 or 5 years. I mean, they tell you if you have a problem, go to a shrink or go to a counselor, do whatever you need to do.
Right.
But they won't go into intrude into your personal life and ask you things. What do you take? Don't take this.
Yeah.
<You know.
laughs> Right. Well, I think it's good to make that distinction, though, because, yeah, I mean, just from the guests that we've had on the show, and either a lot of people don't necessarily know that there's a distinction.
Yes.
You know, and things have changed over the years, or, you know, it's just kind of a common misconception or whatever the case may be. But, yeah, it's...
Mm. Even not only me, other addictionologists or people, once you are an addict, they'll be very, very, very be hesitant to give any mood altering drug.
Mm-hmm.
Any mood. I mean, actually what we do is, we are talking last night, let's say I see a patient has a panic disorder for many years and learned using alcohol calms her down.
Mm-hmm.
So she can do things. I'm convinced that she definitely has a panic disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, we'll be 100 times think, am I going to use this? I try to use everything else before I go to a benzo.
Right.
You know, unless they're sober for quite some time and do the right things.
Right.
Then I will be inclined to try.
Right.
And with a close supervision.
Yeah.
Check the website. Is she getting Xanax from somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is she taking any other drugs? Is she going to meetings? You know, like we talked earlier, I make sure they're accountable, that
yeah,
they're doing
yeah.
the right things.
Okay.
You know, I'm not going to give them Xanax or Clonopin and say, see me in a month. You know, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, here's a bottle of pills.
Yeah.
And okay, so now we're starting to talk a little bit about anxiety, which is another common common thing. And the medications for anxiety are generally benzodiazepines?
Yes. Most difficulties, worst illness you can have is anxiety and alcoholism.
Yeah.
I'm talking about not generalized anxiety disorder. We are talking about distinct panic attacks.
Okay.
Where they have sudden surge of palpitations.
Right.
And impending doom.
Right.
And they know, they drink alcohol, obviously it's a tranquilizer, it's going to control them.
Right.
Those are the worst nightmare for us to treat.
And here's where the term, you know, I'm going to ask, this is in here somewhere, but I want to ask you now while I'm thinking about it, is the term self-medication.
Mm-hmm.
Because I hear that all the time, and to me, it's a slippery slope, because it implies that there is an underlying problem.
Yes.
And in some cases, there is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in some cases, there aren't.
Right.
And self-medication can be a justification to use alcohol.
Exactly.
And mm-hmm. So that's a tough one to unwind. That's what you're talking about. That's
yeah.
why it's a nightmare. Because
yeah.
the ones that have real anxiety are self-medicated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we all have anxiety.
To some degree.
To some degree, yes.
Sure.
So, yeah. yeah.
Okay, so how do you go about determining whether or not it's appropriate to use a benzo for, I guess, if they're not using any other medications, if they've been doing the right things for a period of time, if they don't have any other history of abuse?
Mm-hmm.
Of,
mm-hmm. You look at the family history. Let's say
okay.
my mother is an alcoholic
okay.
and I have a panic disorder.
Yeah.
And I developed alcoholism. Even let's say I didn't develop alcoholism. So only my uncle and my mother have alcoholism
yeah.
or substance abuse, and I have a panic disorder. Even then, we hesitate to use benzos.
Yeah.
Because I'm giving them like buying a gun for a suicidal patient. You know? So even though they haven't abused, you're still concerned, am I going to give them likely to abuse because they have the genes?
Yeah. Okay.
You know? So let's say you have the genes and you also been abusing. So in anxiety, what happens is there are three things, right? One is anticipatory anxiety, like what we call what-if syndrome.
Yeah.
Second one is panic attacks.
Right.
Third one is avoidant behaviors. You start avoiding things you think will bring on the anxiety.
Right.
So when you have all those three...
That would be me in airplanes.
Yeah. So specific, we don't worry about
right.
it. Like you do try what, 5 times a year.
Yeah.
So even if you take a Xanax 5 times a year, it's no big deal.
Right.
You know,
right.
we are talking about, you know, day-to-day things. I can't go to the grocery store. I can't drive on
yeah,
Route 14.
Yeah.
Those
yeah.
kinds of people, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
So even then, what you do is you try to deal with the anticipatory anxiety because that brings on the panic attack. So you try to control the anticipatory anxiety with SSRIs, without using benzos.
I see. Without using benzos.
And
you can.
See whether if I less anticipate, I will
then
have less
have
panic attacks.
Attack. Because the panic attacks are the things that are really disabling.
Right.
Most of the things
exactly,
the thing
yeah.
that makes it really bad.
Yeah.
yeah. Okay. All right. Well, and then what about, see, there's another category that I wanted to ask about and that I hear a lot about, and there's a couple other ones, but I'll ask about, I kind of jokingly call them the diagnosis du jour because, you know, ADHD, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that I talk to
yes.
who has a kid who has substance abuse problems, you know, I won't say everyone,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, he has ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, maybe he does, and needs to be, I don't know. So, you know, they probably are going to end up in your office
yeah.
because, you know, they need to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
Because
now we have a better testing now.
Yeah.
Other testing is basically you give Connors, it's a self-rating. I have trouble focusing, I'm jittery, I can't find my car keys. You satisfy, I mean, I can't find my car keys many times.
Right.
We all qualify. Those things you say, yes, 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 the CONUS will show you that you have ADD.
Right.
You know, but
And you know what, the kids that I see are smart enough to know
mm-hmm.
how to answer the questions.
Yeah. Of course.
To get the mm-hmm. to get the substances.
And they tell you, I took my friends, I was so wonderful, I was able to focus.
Yeah.
And I did very well. And I came and did my homework that night.
Yeah,
so
everybody's happy.
Give me
and,
Adderall.
You know, so let's give them some more Adderall or Vyvanse or whatever. And, you know, it's like, now it's become a drug of a pretty common drug of abuse and, you know, trading, selling,
yes,
the whole
yes
underground economy of that.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you handle, I mean, what percentage of the people that come in thinking that they have ADHD actually probably do have what you would diagnose as ADHD?
In high school, usually the teachers, I depend on the teachers.
Okay.
If the teachers, if you look at the ADD rating scales, one for the parents, one for the teacher, one for you.
One for you, not the kid?
I mean, me means kid.
Me means
kid. I'm a patient.
Okay, so
I'm a kid.
Kid, parent, teacher.
Teacher.
All
so
three.
You basically look at the teacher's Connors kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he's jittery, he's disturbing the class, and class clown, and he's always all over the place, and the grades are poor. Then, let's say, even if you try the medication, they have to change. In a month later, his grades has to improve, his homework has to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I won't continue. Why would I continue?
Right, because it's
so
not
you're
happening
as bad as before. Why would you take a drug?
Right.
So, even when you, I'm not talking about addicts. I'm talking about a kid comes to me and say, I have trouble focusing and all those things. So you give that to the teacher, give to the parent, and give to yourself, and you get the information. Let's say the patient's father or uncle has somebody has an addiction, you go to non-stimulants.
Yeah.
Like
okay.
You have Statera and Clonidine, you have other drugs that are non-stimulant, you can't abuse them. So we go for them.
I see.
So the teachers and the parents convince that this kid has, and when you try, you have to make sure that he has, his grades has to improve, his
so
homework
you have to
has
see
to improve.
Improvement.
Yes. Otherwise, you don't continue.
Sure. I mean, that makes perfect sense. And part of the reason I ask is because a lot of the kids that I talk to or that I've seen or, you know,
yes,
the ADHD and the drugs used for the treatment of ADHD somehow seem to be in the landscape of their beginnings of their abuse.
Yes.
And it may not be the thing, it may be ADHD, Adderall,
mm-hmm,
smoking pot, maybe the pot helped the ADHD a little bit,
yes,
and then had some consequence, but it's in the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very difficult to sort all of these things out.
I see people like that.
Yeah.
They have in tag for, let's say, for marijuana, caught smoking marijuana.
Right.
Carrying
right
paraphernalia at school.
Right.
Suspended, come to tag. And says he has ADD. I mean, those are the most difficult patients. Then you have no choice except to try non-stimulants, and they don't like you, and they don't like your treatment.
And then they won't come back.
They don't come back
to another doctor. They don't give them Adderall.
Exactly.
You mentioned Strattera was mm-hmm a non-addictive.
Non-stimulant.
Non-stimulant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Non-addictive, obviously.
Yeah. Okay.
You know what? When we're talking about addictiveness, and I didn't catch that when you were talking about the benzos, but what's the time frame where something like that would be useful or might be becoming, you know, kind of dangerous? You know, is there like a time frame? Like if I took a benzo for a week or a month or a year, is there like, is it just different for everyone?
When?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's
like
not addiction, exact, but.
Addictions and use and abuse,
mm-hmm,
right? So if I use alcohol, like everybody else, I take my wife on Friday, have a glass of wine. Absolutely, I have no problem with alcohol. So in the benzos also, if you use them, I have patients who use, never had any addictions before. You give them 30 pills for 30 days and come back 30 days later, never lose their prescription. I mean, it's not difficult as a physician to find out who's abusing.
Right.
Because they always lose the prescriptions. Their suitcase got lost in the airplane. Their drugs are in the suitcase. Or the dog eat the prescription. You know.
Right.
It doesn't take you. I don't have to be an FBI agent to find out. In 3 months, I know who is abusing.
Right. Because you've gotten those phone calls.
You got the phone calls.
Yeah. We need this. We need that. Yeah.
And we ran out. And I always run out. They call. Supposed to run for 30 days. In 25 days, they go for the refill. The pharmacist calls you.
Right.
Because he can't refill
right
before 30 days. So you get the message that this guy is taking more than I gave it to him.
Right.
And second thing I always tell my patients is, never take, you got in trouble because you abuse, right? Part of this, if you need to change the dosage, you need to call me. Either increase or decrease. You start practicing medicine, that's how we get in trouble. You know.
You need a license for that, I understand.
Yeah.
Self-medication.
Yeah.
Okay.
So self-medication, you know, I think that's the topic. We all need to have a cause and effect.
Right.
You know, I want to justify, for a long time, I justified my own drinking.
Right.
I'm going to say, I'm drinking. My own getting drunk is because of my stomach surgery. I want to explain why am I getting drunk and make fool of myself at home. It's only thing I could think was this all happening. I mean, that's the progression of my illness. I know that. But my explanation at that time, when I was still sick, was it's all because of my stomach surgery. So I don't have stomach. My alcohol goes directly into the duodenum. Uh-huh. It's absorbed, so I get drunk.
You get drunk quicker.
Donkey quicker.
It's the surgery,
it's
not the
surgery,
alcohol.
Surgery, not alcohol.
Yeah. Not thinking, of course, that you could drink less.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You think
of
that.
For the surgery, no problem.
Son of a gun.
Yeah, we all find an excuse for
it. It just seems to work. Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. I think that's a great. Let's take a 5 minute or 3 minute break here. Let's listen to a little music.
We have a little Duke Ellington here for your listening enjoyment, and we'll be back with you in just a few minutes.
All right. Good deal. See you in a few. Okay, we're back. We're back here for the second half with Dr. Ramesh Murray, and interesting conversation so far. Had an interesting conversation, haven't we?
Yeah.
Let me just check and see. Do either? Just sometimes we pass around a pad and take questions from the studio audience.
Okay.
But in lieu of having, do you guys have any questions? Anything come up for you that you want to ask?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
This is really a question that some of my clients ask me that I don't have a good answer for because of my background doesn't prepare me for it. When you say a serotonin uptake, would you explain what that does and what that means?
Okay. The belief is low levels of serotonin will cause depression. So the goal is to increase the serotonin. So the way, so what they do is they inhibit the reuptake. So when it's like a tap, the water comes into the bucket and it leaks from the bucket. So if we cut down the leak from the bucket, slow down the leak, the levels will go higher. So the serotonin is reuptake back, like recirculation. You slow down the recirculation, so the levels will go up. Am I clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Clear.
So that's how these drugs will decrease the reuptake, so the levels will go higher. They're supposed to clear the depression.
Okay. Well, I have clients that are on Cymbalta mm-hmm. for fibromyalgia, and how does that work for the body versus depression?
If you look at the chronic pain, the two things. One is most people with chronic pain have some amount of depression mm-hmm. because your life is limited, you're chronically in pain. So maybe that will increase, they become less depressed, so they're more motivated. But Cymbalta by itself, there are other antidepressants also make you perceive pain less intensely. Not that they're not pain medication, but your brain perceives the pain less intensely, so you don't feel that much of a pain. That's how the Cymbalta works. Either it clears the secondary depression from chronic pain, and second, your brain perceives less of a pain.
Okay.
Does that cover?
So the pain is still there. Could be still there for them in the fibromyalgia.
Yeah, it will be less intense.
I see.
You know,
okay.
instead of 5 or 6, it becomes 3. They give you 0 to 10 for pain. 10 is the severe pain, like acute pain, like appendicitis or any of those things. Chronic pain usually between 5 and 6, so that you perceive it as 3.
Okay, so I don't want to open up a can of worms here, but would you call that healing, or would you call that putting a Band-Aid over the pain?
In chronic pain, your goal is not to, make them functional. You have to decrease their pain perception.
Ah.
If my pain perception is 6, I don't want to leave the house. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to cook. I don't want to clean. I want to lay in the bed. So I become more functional. So I can cook. I can go to the grocery store.
Chronic pain is a syndrome that includes the psychological and emotional as well as the physical.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So that drug that you're talking about, the Cymbalta, mm-hmm. changes the perception, which then changes that whole psychological emotional package.
Right. You become more productive.
Your perception of pain. Your perception of pain is the same as pain, really, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That is pain.
Mm-hmm.
How I perceive pain, if something could happen to me, and that could be a 9
mm-hmm.
for me, and that could be a 4 for
I know.
But can the fibromyalgia be getting worse and you not know it because you're taking that Cymbalta?
See, fibromyalgia is it's not like a diabetes. I can say how much is your blood sugar is. It's like ADD or depression. If you say my depression is bad, how would I measure it's bad or not? You know, we say suicidal is bad. If you're not suicidal, I cannot be suicidal, but it'll be severely disabled with depression.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a self-scoring illness. It's not like, let's say I have diabetes, my blood sugar is 480 and I increase the insulin, my blood sugar comes back to 120, I'm normal. So fibromyalgia, again, there's no set criteria or measures to say this is what it is, this is now it came. It's all self-perception.
Got it.
Other than, yeah. Okay, and I think...
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
I did. Okay, Doc, what does low testosterone play? How does that play in depression?
Since I think this ad came in the news, in the TV,
yeah.
They say low testosterone will your depression and your manhood and this will improve and you're right on the skin. I don't know. It's like even though I saw in the literature some people responded to using testosterone, I have no experience myself, you know. But even if you look at the literature, it's not that many. They complain about like 2% of the population.
Yeah.
They improve, I believe, by testosterone.
Oh.
You know, but when I saw them, the people who ask me for testosterone, their levels are normal. So if the levels are low, giving a testosterone is fine. Like diabetes, you know, blood sugar is high, you give insulin to lower the blood sugar. Your testosterone level is low, you give the testosterone so that their bone growth or masculinity and other things are improved. But I don't know about depression, even though I saw on the literature saying that people taking testosterone, their mood has improved.
Okay.
See, I haven't seen that ad, but I have been tested, and I have been shown in tests that I have, this is Daniel speaking, by the way, this isn't Rick and Chris.
I could clear
can
up.
We make, just as a, just, yeah, and just, yeah, maybe, well, can we, maybe we don't want to go to a personal question.
Yeah, you're right. Okay.
On the air. And then maybe that we can take care of the personal questions after.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, legitimate questions. Uh-huh. And I'm glad you asked them, but I think it would be better to cover a couple more general things here, if that's okay. Is anything going on that you have in your head? Okay. One of the things that I wanted to ask about is what is an alcoholic or a somebody has an addictions problem, what can they do about chronic pain if they can't use opiate pain medication what do we do with a person that has chronic pain? Is that another nightmare case?
I'm not like an addict. Somehow I feel people have a drug of choice.
Right.
You know, if my drug of choice is not opiates and is then disabling pain, and as long as it's properly monitored, I don't see anything wrong. You know, oh no.
Okay. So
I'll
words,
tell you one thing.
If an alcoholic's drug of choice is not opiates or an opioid
drugs,
then a monitored use of those kinds of pain medications could be okay.
If it's a proven, let's just say I have a back pain and I have no medical evidence, my MRI on the back is normal, then I say I'm in pain.
Right.
See, then is the problem.
No, if you have an evidence, that's for you.
Yeah. So I can't say you don't have pain, but I feel uncomfortable to give opiates for them.
Right.
If you have, you know, bulging disc or, you know, you go to physical therapy, it doesn't help, you know, then, you know, I'll be more open.
Right.
To say, okay, you know.
Okay, so it sounds like it's a difficult question that you have to ask. You have to manage that carefully.
Now there are drugs, agonist and antagonist at the same time.
Yeah.
So you don't get the euphoria.
Okay.
People use drugs that have both agonist and antagonist.
Yeah, like
so
Suboxone.
Like Suboxone, for example. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It blocks the, so it has a what we call a ceiling effect. After 24 milligrams, no matter how much you take, doesn't give the buzz.
Right.
It does give the sense of well-being. So people can abuse Suboxone because it does give the sense of well-being. But again, it's a ceiling effect. So you can't, like alcohol, like the lady, the European singer who died, forgot her name. Remember the singer who died from alcohol intoxication?
Yes.
Amy Winehouse?
Amy Winehouse. Thank you. Yeah. So yeah, I lost my thought.
Well, we were talking about Suboxone, the ceiling.
Because the ceiling, you can't get after 24. No matter how much you take, nothing happens.
But when she died of alcohol poisoning, the alcohol does not have the ceiling, so she drank herself to death.
Exactly.
I see. Okay, because that's one thing that comes up in the recovery community. People wonder what to do about that. You know, I mean, there's we're dealing with that today. You
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
as that is you know that kind of thing. What kind of legitimate prescription drugs are the most commonly abused that you know of? What's out there?
Right now in McHenry County, I think you are saying too, most common drug is prescription opiates.
Prescription
Narco,
opiates.
Vicodin, Narco, Vicodin, Oxycontin.
Okay.
Very popular.
Okay. Very popular. Okay.
How about Ritalin?
Ritalin, people abuse, they like Adderall better than Ritalin. Because Adderall is more stronger, you know.
Can we talk a little bit about what kind of drugs are used for detox and what you know about that? Like what when somebody's detoxing from alcohol, when somebody's detoxing from opiates?
See, detoxing, I believe, has to be done in the hospital.
Okay.
You can't do it as an outpatient because, again, you're giving them medication. We have no monitoring.
Okay.
And DTs.
You're talking about alcohol?
Alcohol, DTs, can 50% can die.
Okay.
So there's a high risk. It's not like a simple illness like pneumonia. You can take penicillin, you know.
Right.
So I feel these guys has to be detoxed for 5 days in the hospital. They come out clean.
Right.
And work from there.
Okay. Line. And what kind of medications are used in detox? And I assume that's it. That's their very short term.
Yeah, benzos, basically.
Benzos?
Typically, people use lorazepam, diazepam, clonazepam, any of the PAMs.
Okay. All.
Any PAMs.
Any PAMs. All right. And then what about detox from opiates and how is that done and is that generally done in the hospital, not in the hospital? How does that work?
So opiates, basically they get sick like a dog, but they won't die like alcohol.
Okay.
The risk of death is very low. I mean, it's very painful DTs because they're sick like a dog. They throw up diarrhea and hot flashes. I mean, I can see them in my waiting room when they come in opiate withdrawal.
Right.
You can see they are sick.
They have the flu.
Severe flu.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So how do you... What happened was Rosecrans, one of the premier hospitals in town, they tried to detox them on Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
Before, we used to use clonidine, which is not a mood-altering drug. Now, since Suboxone came... So what Rosecrans did was, initially, I think 6-7 years ago, they just used to detox them on 5 days on Suboxone and send them home.
Mm-hmm.
And they come back in a month again, in a DTs again, in opiate withdrawal. So that's why they started using Suboxone for maintenance.
Okay.
So that's how, so initially it came as a detox drug, just to detox them in 5 days or 10 days and send them home with no medication.
Right. And we're talking about detoxing either from heroin or from other
prescription opiates. Yes. Oxycontin, any of them.
Right, because Suboxone is got the agonist and the...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's what you call a partial agonist. It's like it's not an opiate. So if you take a urine test, it doesn't show as an opiate because it's not an opiate.
Okay.
But it is what you call a partial agonist, means like your first cousin. He's like you, but he's not you.
Right. You know? A couple of the same genes.
Yeah.
But you might see the resemblance. Okay. Yeah. All right. So they're using Suboxone more as a maintenance.
So Suboxone we use for four reasons. One is obviously for detoxing. Second is it gives a sense of well-being, so they don't crave to go for opiates again.
Right.
Third one, it blocks the outside opiates. If I take Suboxone, I can shoot heroin, nothing happens to me. It blocks it.
Okay.
You know, because they give naltrexone, which is an antagonist.
Yeah.
Because of the antagonist, anything you take from outside, it's blocked.
Right.
Okay. If you do too much to unblock it, you go into precipitated withdrawal, severe withdrawal, sick like a dog.
Right.
Like withdrawing, sick like a dog.
Right.
So that's the three reasons we use it, because they can't use as long as they take Suboxone.
Hmm.
Now we have naltrexone injections now, which is like an antabuse.
Okay.
But it's for a month. So you give a shot for a month. You take any opiates, you get sick like a dog.
Okay.
So when do I use it? I probably have maybe 3 patients. So they repeatedly fail. So, you know, if I'm on Suboxone, I can stop one day on 36 hours and I can start using again.
Okay.
So I can show my wife I took Suboxone, not do it on Friday. Saturday, I get my paycheck and I can use it. I have patients exactly like that.
Yeah.
So then they repeatedly fail, then we use Vivitrol, which is a naltrexone, an injection form once a month.
Right.
Initially, it is approved for alcoholism.
Yeah. And now we've had a mutual.
Yeah. So now they use it for
right.
opiate
I see.
Addiction.
Okay. We're actually time has gone fast and we're running out. But I guess we covered most of the things, because I guess one of the other questions I was going to ask is about the cravings. You mentioned the Vivitrol. And I guess what I want to talk about, just we didn't talk about bipolar, and that's another one of those
right.
Diagnosis du jour mm-hmm. kind of things that, you know, and so can you say anything briefly about how that fits in with what you see in terms of recovery and the people you see that have bipolar? You know, I'll just say from my experience, there's a lot fewer people that look to me like they actually have the disease of bipolar than feel like they do.
Yeah. You see, if you look in the literature, they say 50% of the bipolar patients abuse mood altering drugs when they're high. They want to calm themselves down.
Okay.
But if you look at alcoholics and see how many of them has bipolar, probably very few. Do you follow me? If you look at the bipolar patient,
right.
you know, his risk is very high to abuse drugs
right.
like cocaine or alcohol, whatever it is. When they're low, they use cocaine. When they're high, they use alcohol.
Right.
You know, and we have a mutual client, I think, Debbie sees him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a clear manic. Mm-hmm. He bought 6 motorbikes, 4 snowmobiles,
yeah,
and 2 trucks to carry them. You know, classic. He comes
right.
to my office and he acts and he can't stop.
Right.
Yeah. And he's in recovery. He's a board member. He's a very, I think 17 years he's been clean.
Yeah.
Always kind of hypomanic. Just somehow he was, so he justifies buying these motorbikes to make money by fixing them, which he does,
mm-hmm.
and which makes sense to an extent, but not to the extent he has 7 bikes. One of them is a BMW. He bought it for $20,000. You know, and
so there's functional. There's kind of like functional manics.
Hypomanic.
Okay. So.
And those drugs are non-mood altering anyway. None of the drugs we use for bipolar are mood altering.
Okay.
They're all mood stabilizers. They have no way you can abuse them. They're mostly anti-seizure drugs.
Okay.
So you can't abuse them.
Okay.
And they're safe for people take seizure drugs the rest of their life. So they're very safe.
So if someone, in essence, if someone thinks that they have that kind of a problem, they can go get a diagnosis or get an opinion. And if they need to be medicated for that,
mm-hmm.
that the drugs that are used for that are not mood altering.
Absolutely
anyway.
Not mood altering.
Let me ask you one last question, and then I'm going to have to close. But I guess, what would you say? What advice would you give to the recovering community in terms of what would the dangers be? What warning would you give if you could say in general what to be careful about in terms of drugs for the recovering community?
As long as they honestly tell the physician they're in recovery,
mm-hmm.
most physicians will think twice giving drugs that can alter their mood
okay.
or can get them hooked on. They will try to avoid those things. You know,
okay.
most doctors.
So be straight with your physician.
Have to be honest and say I'm in recovery. My
yeah.
patients who are on Suboxone, I give them a card in their wallet to carry them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I always talk to the dentist. We plan when we stop the Suboxone, when you get the dental work done,
mm-hmm.
when they stop the opiates again, when they go back. So you have to be closely monitored.
Okay. All right. All right. That one's going to, it's a good question. It's going to have to wait. I've got one minute. Okay. So at this point, I think we're going to have to close, even though we got lots more to talk about. We could talk for another hour. We just got started.
Yeah,
yeah, we
bring him back.
Well, we would if we could get the poor. You know, we have to make this poor guy con on a Sunday night.
I'll pick him up.
Well, we'll spread it out a little bit. How's that?
Come
we'll
on, more time. Yes,
Sunday off.
Yeah.
But thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. And and thank you to our studio audience, to our listeners, thank you for making us a successful little underground support source for the recovering community. We'll email our reminders for next week's show. As always, we try to look at recovery from a wide and open testing from. Help in your neighbor, and together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. We hope you've enjoyed the show. See you at 8 p.m. next Sunday night.
Thank you, Rick.